Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 through 30. The seventh talk in a series on Philippians was presented by Ron Julian on October 13, 2013 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Welcome to Reformation Fellowship. We are in our seventh week in a series on the book of Philippians. Let me remind you of the circumstances of the letter. Many years before, Paul had come to Philippi in response to a vision calling him to come to Macedonia, to Greece. He founded a church there and, as it happens, also got mightily beat up. Now, these many years later, Paul is in prison, perhaps in Rome, the imprisonment that's described at the end of the book of Acts. The Philippians have sent him some generous financial support, and this is the letter that Paul is writing back to them. We've been looking at the first major exhortation in the letter. It started in chapter 1, verse 27. Paul said, "Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ." They have committed themselves to the set of ideas found in the gospel story. Now Paul is urging them to embrace those beliefs with such sincerity that they affect the way they live. He wants them to conduct themselves in a way that is fitting in keeping with this gospel that they say they believe. And to be specific, in this context, he wants them to extend to each other brotherly love and patience. In spite of the many ways they may disagree, he wants their common hope and faith to bring them together in one mind. And it certainly looks like this is an area where they are having some problems, because he speaks to it a fair amount. Last week we saw that Paul takes this very seriously. Nothing less is at stake than working out their salvation with fear and trembling. So he's not just urging them to behave better or be nicer. He is urging them to actually confront the fact that this gospel, which is their salvation, in order for them to embrace it and believe it in a sincere way, they're going to have to face the implications for how they live. That working out how they conduct themselves together is part of working out their salvation. Okay, so today we're going to look at the end of that exhortation and a little bit more. So we're starting in 2:14. Let me read you the end of the exhortation. "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may come to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine like stars in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may have cause to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering with the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. And you too rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me." Okay, so this is the part that I mainly want to talk about today. This is the conclusion of the first major exhortation of the letter. But this is sort of what I want to concentrate on. I would like to go a little farther into what Paul says here, so I'm going to do this backwards. We're going to continue to read, and I want to talk about what he says after this first, and then we're going to come back and look more carefully at what he says in this concluding part of the exhortation. So let me continue to read on to the end of the chapter, and let's talk about that a little bit first. "But I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you shortly, so that I also may be encouraged when I learn of your condition. For I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare. For they all seek after their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know of his proven worth, that he served with me in the furtherance of the gospel like a child his father. Therefore, I hope to send him immediately, as soon as I see how things go with me, and I trust in the Lord that I myself also shall be coming shortly. But I thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger and minister to my need, because he was longing for you all and was distressed because you had heard that he was sick. For indeed he was sick to the point of death, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore I have sent him all the more eagerly, in order that when you see him again you may rejoice, and I may be less concerned. Therefore receive him in the Lord with all joy, and hold men like him in high regard, because he came close to death for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was deficient in your service to me. Okay, so we can see in this section Paul is sorting out the details of his interaction with the Philippians. I mean, remember, it's probably pretty obvious, but it's helpful to stop and remind ourselves that Paul is currently under arrest and he cannot visit them. And communications back then are just not like communications are with us now. We think nothing of talking to anyone in the world, any place, these days, immediately, and in fact see their picture while we're talking to them. But in Paul's situation, if any contact happens at all between him and the Philippians, it has to be by people traveling back and forth. So we see in Paul's comments here three different ways that he hopes to communicate with them. First, in time, he is sending Epaphroditus back to them with this letter. Epaphroditus is one of the Philippians. He brought the gift of financial support from the Philippians, and evidently the plan was for him to stay a while and help Paul on behalf of the Philippians. You know, they can't all be there, but Epaphroditus can be there and be helping Paul out. But Epaphroditus got very sick and almost died. He was now longing to see his people again, and he was upset because someone had carried the news of his illness back home, and he didn't want them to worry. So you can understand the situation. He almost died. All his people are in Philippi. He's homesick. He wants to be there. He doesn't want them to worry about him. And so Paul is sending him back to Philippi. Epaphroditus will be the one who will deliver this letter that Paul is writing. So that's how they will get this letter, is Epaphroditus will take it back with him. They will rejoice that they have Epaphroditus back, and that will give Paul one less thing to worry about. Okay, the Philippians, now they know Epaphroditus is okay, they're back together, everything's cool, so I can stop worrying about them, in, at least in that regard. Paul commends Epaphroditus to them. Hold men like him in high regard, he says, because he risked his life doing the work of Christ. We might just comment briefly on this strange phrase that Paul uses right at the end of the chapter. Epaphroditus risked his life to complete what was deficient in your service to me. It sounds cold. Paul sounds like he's looking down his nose at them. Your service to me, unfortunately, was quite deficient, or something like that, which is not at all, I think, what Paul means. I think if you think about the situation, it's not really likely at all that that's what Paul means. After all, it was the Philippians' idea to send the financial support. It was the Philippians' idea to send Epaphroditus. So I think Paul is describing things from their perspective. Epaphroditus came to serve Paul on behalf of the Philippians. From their perspective, the distance between Rome and Philippi made it hard to help Paul the way they wanted to. They wished that they could be right there with him, helping him out. So in their minds, their help of Paul was lacking. They couldn't do all that they might want to do. That's why they sent Epaphroditus to give Paul money and to stay and to help him for a while. Epaphroditus was making up for what they regretted was lacking in their ability to help Paul. So I don't think Paul is criticizing them for somehow being deficient in their service. He's describing their perspective, the reason why they sent Epaphroditus in the first place. So I don't think it's at all intended to be any sort of criticism of them or anything like that. But now Paul is sending Epaphroditus back, and that's the first way that Paul will be able to communicate with them. Epaphroditus will bring this letter to them and presumably tell them about his experiences and what he knows of Paul's situation and so on. Okay, then secondly, Paul hopes to send Timothy to them a little bit later. He wants Timothy to wait until they find out what is the disposition of Paul's case going to be, so that they know a little better how this is going to go and Timothy can report that to them. He wants to send Timothy to be of help to them, but he also wants to send Timothy for his own sake, for Paul's sake. When Epaphroditus returns to Philippi, he's going to stay there. That's where he's from. He's going to take the letter, but he's not coming back. But Paul would like to hear how they're doing. I mean, Paul is very concerned about all the people to whom he has preached the gospel. He wants to know, how is it going for them? And in particular, how is their faith going? How are they doing in the pursuit of the faith? And so he wants to send his own man, Timothy. Timothy cares about them. Timothy will be of help to them. And then Timothy will return to Paul and let him know what's going on. Now, Paul says something very harsh here at this spot. Timothy is the only person with Paul that he could call on to make this trip. He says, I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare, for they all seek after their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. Paul would like to have people around him who care as much about the people of Christ as he does himself. He would like to have people around him to whom he could say, it would really be great if we could find out how the Philippians are doing, and they would say, I'll go on that trip, I'll take your message to them, I'll see how they're doing, I'll come back. Well, Paul has one guy of whom that's true. Timothy will go. Timothy cares about the Philippians. Timothy is doing the work of the gospel. Timothy is willing to go on this trip and find out what's going on. But it seems that Paul is saying that there aren't others who would be willing to invest their time in a long trip like that from Rome to Philippi to look after the spiritual welfare of the Philippians. Obviously, we don't know much about the situation. I'm inclined to think that Paul is not saying, I have a bunch of losers around me here. I have all these people here who are supposedly helping me, but none of them are any good. I couldn't send any of them. They're all selfish people. I don't think that he means that. I think what he's saying is that I am largely alone in this work, that there are people who come by sometimes to see how I'm doing, but there aren't any people who have really thrown in their lot with me to say, let me work with you, let me help you accomplish what you're trying to do. And that is a sad thing. It's an understandable thing, I think, but sad nonetheless. One thing I would point out here, earlier in this exhortation, we saw that Paul said to them, do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. That's what he said to the Philippians in his exhortation. Here, Paul is using the exact same phrase about the people that he doesn't have helping him, because those who could be helping him, they all seek after their own interests. And it's exactly the same phrase. Literally, it's their own things. So he's encouraging the Philippians not to be concerned just with their own things, but to be concerned about each other. And now he says that Timothy is the only person with him that he can count on to be concerned about more than his own things. So I think part of the reason that Paul says this may be as kind of an object lesson for the Philippians. He is encouraging them to be like Timothy. Care about something more than just your own personal concerns, just as Timothy cares about you. I mean, they can recognize in Timothy's concern, in Timothy's willingness to sacrifice himself to come and see how they're doing, that there's something that they appreciate in that. And so I think there's this implication that Paul is encouraging them not to be like those ones who are concerned only with their own interests. Timothy, remember, has a personal connection with the Philippians. As a very young man, he started his travels with Paul by visiting Philippi when the church was first founded. Paul had just met Timothy and had taken him on with him when Paul got the message to go over to Macedonia, and Timothy traveled with him on that trip. So that was the first thing that Timothy did with Paul, was to go to Philippi. And he must have been very young when the Philippians first met him. Paul writes a letter to Timothy saying, "Let no one look down on your youthfulness." That's in 1 Timothy. But that letter was probably written around 15 years after Paul first met Timothy and he first met the Philippians. So 15 years after he was meeting the Philippians, Paul was saying to him, "Don't let anyone look down on your youthfulness." So if he was still youthful 15 years later, he must have been very young when he started with Paul. Probably not much more than a boy. And the Philippians know that Timothy has shown concern for them over these many years. He has been with Paul. He has, if I'm remembering correctly, Timothy has been there since, in this time, in the time since the church was first founded. So they know him and they know his concern. So Paul is going to send Timothy to them, and this is the second way that he hopes to keep in touch with the Philippians. Epaphroditus will bring the letter from Paul, and then he hopes that soon after, he says, that he will be able to send Timothy, and Timothy will help them and then communicate with Paul as to what's going on. And then third, Paul hopes to see them himself. He says, "I trust in the Lord that I myself also shall be coming shortly." Remember, Paul is under arrest, and in human terms, the outcome is far from assured. Is Paul going to be released, or he could end up being executed? But remember, earlier in the letter, he said some things that really made it sound like he was convinced that he understood what God intended for him, and that God intended for him to continue on in ministry to people like the Philippians. So he was confident that he was not going to be executed. And here's one more bit of strong evidence that Paul confidently expected to be released from his arrest. He's saying, "I trust in the Lord that I myself also shall be coming shortly." That's what he expected to happen. We don't know, but tradition tells us that that is in fact what happened, that Paul was released and went on to have further ministry before he was finally executed in Rome several years later. The New Testament doesn't tell us, so we're not certain about that. Okay, so a little bit of a picture of how hard it was for Paul to be involved with the churches that he founded. And in this situation, even harder, he's far away. Communications are not instantaneous, but in this case, he's in prison. He can't come and see them, even if he wanted to. And so he has to depend on people delivering letters who are traveling to and from where he is and where he's trying to communicate with. He has to depend on people like Timothy, who are willing to make the sacrifice of committing themselves to a major trip in order to go and see how people are doing. He's working very hard to check up on them and give them the encouragement that he wants them to have. Okay, so that's his circumstance. That's how Paul pictures what's going to be happening in this interaction with himself and the Philippians. Now, I want to back up again to verse 14. And let's finish the exhortation that he was giving them before he talked about the travel plans and so forth. So, the first sentence there, starting in verse 14, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may come to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine like stars in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may have cause to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain." Okay, so first of all, I'd like to point out that it's quite likely that Paul is making an allusion to what is referred to as the Song of Moses here. Just before Moses died, he wrote a poem, delivered a poetic address to Israel that talks about their wayward rebellion and the price they're going to pay for that, and how God ultimately will one day have mercy on them and gather them back together. So this, the Song of Moses, is Moses critiquing Israel, prophetically predicting that they are going to turn away from God and pay the price for that, and that ultimately God will have mercy on them and bring them back together. That address that he gives to them is referred to as the Song of Moses. It's found in Deuteronomy 32. In Deuteronomy 32:5, Moses says this about Israel: "They have acted corruptly toward God. They are not his children because of their defect, but are a perverse and crooked generation." Okay, so there are several points of contact between that verse and what Paul says here to the Philippians. Moses says that they have, we have it translated here, defect. It's a blemish, a flaw. There is something wrong with them. And it is that they are stained, flawed with their own rebellion and corruption. They are not faithfully following God, but they're turning away from him. Paul uses this word in Philippians, or rather he uses the opposite of this word. He wants the Philippians to be different than Israel was. He wants them to be without flaw, without blemish, without blameworthiness in their faith. And this is the word that is translated blameless, that you may be blameless and innocent. So that may seem like a small connection, but it's just the beginning of the connections. But we have that in the Greek translation of the Song of Moses, this, when they're described as being blemished, Paul says, "I want you to be without that blemish, without that blameworthiness." Okay. Next, Moses says that the rebellious Israelites are not the children of God. But Paul says he wants the lives of the Philippians to show that they are children of God. And then finally, Moses calls the Israelites a perverse and crooked generation. Paul uses the same phrase, but wants the Philippians to be different from the crooked and perverse generation in which they live. Now, I don't know how much weight we want to put on that necessarily. I don't know how much Paul expected that the Philippians would notice the way he was borrowing the language of the Song of Moses. But it makes sense in this context that Paul would use such language, I think, whether he was specifically meaning to point at the Song of Moses or not, there's a similar idea being explored here. Moses was charging the Israelites with being illegitimate children, with being faithless followers of God. God had brought them together to be his people, but they were not really children of God. They were blemished with insincerity and rebellion. Instead, they were corrupt, perverse, crooked. What Paul wants is for the Philippians to be genuine. He wants them to not be like what Israel was at that time. The Israelites were blemished with insincerity, with a falsehood of faith. But Paul wants the Philippians to be unblemished in the sincerity of their faith. The Israelites showed themselves not to be children of God. Paul wants the Philippians to show themselves to be children of God. The Israelites were a crooked and perverse generation. Paul wants the Philippians, who live in a perverse and crooked generation, to stand out as different. Another way to put it is the way Paul put it a verse back. In other words, Paul wants them to work out their salvation with fear and trembling. Paul makes it very clear in this passage that their choices about how they treat each other are life and death choices. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you may be blameless and innocent. You may be children of God, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ, Paul will turn out not to have run in vain. And what does that last mean? What would it mean for Paul to have run in vain? He has been preaching the gospel to the Philippians. But what if on the day of Christ, the day when Christ returns to judge everything, it turns out that they had not listened to Paul? They would not abandon their grumbling and disputing. Their faith was not genuine and without blemish. They were not genuine children of God. They did not hold fast the word of life. Well then, all Paul's preaching and encouragement was in vain. This connection between how they treat each other and their salvation is important to Paul. We have been seeing that all along. That's what he's been talking about in this exhortation. He says here, if they indeed live out their faith in this way, they will shine like stars in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. I want to say more about that in a minute, but let's finish verses 17 and 18 first. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering with the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. And you too rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. This is actually a little tricky to understand, I think. What does it mean to be poured out as a drink offering with the sacrifice and service of your faith? Well, at first glance, if you think about the structure of it, it could mean the same thing as running in vain and toiling in vain. Paul could be saying, on the day when Christ returns, I do not want to find out that my preaching to you has been in vain. But even if it turns out that I have been running in vain, that I have been poured out as a drink offering, that would make a sort of sense. The problem with this option, of course, is that Paul goes on to say that he rejoices in this, and then he wants them to rejoice as well. So that doesn't really make any sense. Even if it turns out that all my preaching to you was in vain and none of you inherit eternal life, I rejoice and I want you to rejoice. That doesn't make sense. So I don't think that's what he means. Maybe Paul means the opposite of that. Being poured out as a drink offering means that his work as an apostle was not in vain. They truly did believe through his ministry. Well, how would that be? A drink offering, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on the sacrificial system, but as I understand it, the drink offering was poured out alongside of the main sacrifice. So the metaphor could be something like this. The Philippians are, in their faith, pictured as making the main sacrifice and service to God. Paul's ministry is like the drink offering that is poured out along with that, that accompanies that. So Paul could be saying, on the day when Christ returns, I do not want to find out that my preaching to you has been in vain. But if indeed I have not been running in vain, if my work is like a drink offering poured out along with the sacrifice of your faith offered to God, then I rejoice. So my little bit, my little drink offering accompanying your main sacrifice that's being put on the altar, I rejoice in that if it turns out that that's what's going on. That seems quite possible to me. I think that may be what he means. But there is another possibility as well. He might mean, even if I die. That is, He has been saying that he expects to be freed from his imprisonment, but what if he is executed instead? Paul could be saying, even if my ministry of the gospel to you and to others leads to my death, I rejoice that I have helped you in the faith, and I want you to rejoice as well. The biggest question is if that would fit into the flow of thought, and I think it does. Paul might be saying something like this: on the day when Christ returns, I do not want to find out that my preaching to you has been in vain. But if it turns out that my preaching was not in vain, and yet I die in the process, if it turns out that my life was poured out like a drink offering accompanying your genuine sacrifice of faith to God, then I rejoice. So here, the pouring out of the drink offering is not just Paul's ministry, but it is his life, that he has paid for the privilege of helping the church in coming to grow an understanding of the gospel with his life in being executed. With either option, Paul is rejoicing at the genuine faith of the Philippians. If his ministry has been a part of their genuine faith and salvation, then he rejoices and he wants them to rejoice. And perhaps there is the added idea that even if it were to result in my death, still we should rejoice. Because this is Paul's total preoccupation, that the people to whom he preaches the gospel actually embrace it and find life. This is everything to him. This is all that he really concerns himself with in his letters, is how are you guys doing? Are you taking this in or not? Are you going to find life or are you turning away from it? Okay, so I would like to go back then and talk about two important ideas that we find in this concluding part of the exhortation. The first is this idea that Paul has been talking about throughout this whole section, the connection between how we treat each other and our salvation. A very uncomfortable topic, I think. We've been talking about this for several weeks. Let me remind you again of the language we have been seeing in this section. On the one hand, a lot of language about how the Philippians should relate to each other, like, in one spirit, with one mind striving together, maintaining the same love, intent on one purpose. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. With humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own interests, but also for the interests of others. Have the attitude of self-sacrificial service that Jesus had. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. That's a whole list of the kinds of things that he's been saying in this exhortation, all about how they treat each other and deal with conflicts amongst themselves. But on the other hand, along with that language, a lot of language about how this attitude is related to their faith and indeed related to their salvation. Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel. Stand firm. Strive for the faith of the gospel. If there is any encouragement in Christ, then be united in mind. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Be blameless and innocent. Be children of God above reproach. Hold fast the word of life. May I, Paul, have cause to glory on the day of Christ because I have not run in vain. That is, my preaching to you was not in vain because you genuinely embraced the gospel. Paul believes that their choice concerning how they treat each other is related to their choice concerning their salvation. And as we have discussed, that is a scary thought because we all fail to treat each other as well as we should. I may have mentioned here before that I have something of a phobia against repeating myself in public. You wouldn't think so, listening to my teaching, but I do. And a person with such a phobia should not be a teacher of the New Testament because the same ideas keep coming up again and again. So what I'm about to say is something, if you've been around here at all, you have heard me say before. And I always feel like apologizing for that because I don't like to repeat myself. But the fact is, this is the deal. This is the stuff that the New Testament talks about over and over again. I certainly have talked about it a lot. And it's important for us to deal with this because we, as Protestants, have inherited this, in many ways, wonderful idea that we are justified by faith, and that means it is not my performance, it is not how well I avoid sin that reconciles me with God, but is the grace of God manifested through Christ's death on the cross, the forgiveness that God is extending to us in spite of the fact that we are not what we ought to be. And that is absolutely true. But the problem that we always bump up against is, and yet, we find places like this where Paul seems to be connecting the way we conduct ourselves with whether, in fact, we are working out our salvation and whether, in the end, we are going to arrive as citizens of the kingdom of God. So, what is it? Is my salvation dependent on how I live or not, or sort of, or how does that work? Well, this idea that I think helps us to understand what is happening with that is one of the great common themes in the New Testament, and it is the idea that God uses the circumstances of life to test our faith. What we call saving faith is a marriage of two things. There is the gospel, which we believe. It is a story that gives us new information. It is revelation. It is God saying, this is what I'm doing. Here's where we're going. This is your hope. This is a new picture of the world. The gospel comes along and says, this is in fact what's going on. This is where life is to be found. This is who you are. This is why you need to be forgiven. And the whole picture that it paints. But the gospel itself, that's only part of the story. This new information, this new picture of the world, must be received in a willing heart. That is, a heart that is touched by the Spirit of God, a heart that is actually open and willing to admit, I have been in the wrong, God is right, I need the salvation and forgiveness that God is bringing, and so forth. So both of those things have to come together. The revelation that is in the gospel and a willingness to believe, not just sure that's a good idea, yes, I'll join this church, yes, I like that way of looking at the world, but actually believing it, actually saying, yes, that is how I see the world. I talked about that a lot last week, but I think that's always at the heart of this, is what does it mean to be saved by faith? It means to actually believe, genuinely believe, that the gospel story is true and relevant to me. Now, the reality is that we are sinners, and we continue to be sinners after we become genuine believers. Genuine believers are very much sinners in this world, and so there is a great deal of inertia in us. We would like to not have to face any major life changes. I mean, sure, you know, if I've been robbing banks and stuff, okay, yeah, I'll give it up. I know I have to give that up. But I would like to basically continue my self-centered way of looking at life as much as I can. I mean, I know I have to give some things up, but I would like, in many ways, for this new perspective that the gospel is giving me to sort of back off and give me some room. You know, I've got my way of doing things. I think it's natural. I mean, if I could get away with it, I would like the gospel to save me without greatly inconveniencing me in the process. So God takes us through situations that force us to confront this new worldview. And like I say, I think this is just over and over and over again. This is what Jesus talks about in many places. This is what Paul talks about. This is what James talks about and Peter talks about and Hebrews talks about. This idea that we're going to bump up against those things that in one way or another confront us with the reality of the gospel. That this is really true. You have to face into the question, is God trustworthy? Am I going to follow him now that I realize that life looks like this? And so this is the process of testing our faith, or various kinds of language are used, but often it's described in those terms. Suppose that some person has hurt me. Now I have to think in earnest about what the gospel says about forgiveness. Okay, yeah, I'm a sinner, my sins are forgiven, but now the issue of forgiveness is on the front burner because I have been the recipient of hurt, and I have to think about what does it mean to forgive a sinner when I've got a sinner who's been in my face and I'm suffering for it. I have lost my job, maybe. Now I have to think in earnest about what it means to trust God and what I am trusting him for. And we could describe many, many sorts of situations. The New Testament describes various ways in which God uses things in life to confront us with one or more of the fundamental truths of the gospel. What do you want? What is your hope? What is most important? Do you need to be forgiven? Do you really believe that there is a God there? And on and on and on. It is a painful process, but through these difficult situations, the willingness of our heart to embrace the truth becomes visible in our lives. We cannot merely say we believe it. We are forced to decide whether, in fact, we do believe it, and that has a mark, an impact on the way we live. If what I'm saying here is not true, then you should not really listen to much of anything I have to say about the Bible, because that is my fundamental understanding of what is at the heart of the life of the believer in this age. It is going through that process, and I see the Bible talking about it over and over again. That's what God has on his mind, to test our faith, to refine our faith, to mature our faith, by forcing us to have to confront what we really think about things in the midst of the difficulties of life. And whether we like it or not, this is clearly a very valuable process to God. Well, I think it's quite apparent then that this is how Paul sees the situation of the Philippians. They are facing the outside pressure of persecution. They are facing the internal pressure within the church of contentious disputes. They're not getting along with each other. And Paul is saying these are the circumstances in which you must work out your salvation. If you really believe this gospel and are willing to embrace it, then sooner or later it's going to become clear to you that your persecutors will fail in the end, and God will not fail you. If you are willing to embrace this gospel as true, then you will come to understand that you share a common faith, a common hope, a common destiny with your fellow believers, and that means something. If you are willing to embrace this gospel as true, then you will come to know that Jesus has shown us what real self-sacrificial compassion looks like. That's the sort of thing that Paul has been saying in this exhortation. That is why Paul can start a sentence with, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing," and then end that sentence with, "So that in the day of Christ I may have cause to glory that I did not run in vain." He's saying, if you will not let the truth of the gospel penetrate into your life enough to influence how you treat each other, then I have preached the gospel to you in vain. Not because sinners don't get saved. All of us will fail to be what we ought to be to each other. All of us will be more unloving than we should be, less generous than we should be. We are sinners, and it is a struggle for us to deal with those issues. But it's one thing to admit, I'm a sinner who needs to be forgiven because I am often not treating people as well as I should. There's a difference between that and digging in our heels and refusing to let the gospel influence how we live. Refusing to acknowledge, yes, that's the truth. That's what we ought to be seeking. That's what we ought to be about. If we do dig in our heels in that way, we are showing that our hearts are unwilling to submit to the truth, whatever we may say we believe. It is in the circumstance where we have to decide whether we're going to be generous, whether we're going to care about the fact that that irritating fellow believer is in fact my brother in Christ. It's when I have to make those decisions that now real things are on the line for me, and I'm having to make some really important spiritual decisions about whether this gospel means something to me or not. That's what I think Paul has been getting at in this entire exhortation. That's why he keeps telling them to get along, because the decisions they're making about how they treat each other are that's the arena in which they are working out whether the gospel is significant to them or not. Certainly, they're going to fail. Certainly, there are going to be times when it gets messy and it doesn't look the way we would like. But the question is, are they willing to see the implications of the gospel that Paul is pointing out to them or not? The last thing I wanted to talk about, the other thing that I wanted to talk about from that section, is the statement that Paul talks about believers shining like stars in the world. We are like these lights in the darkness. For many of us, this can be hard to swallow for any number of reasons. We don't personally feel like lights in the darkness. And as we look around at the world, we wonder if there are any lights in the darkness out there. For one thing, there is not a lot. No, that's the wrong way to put that. I knew I was going to do that. What I have written here, what I mean to say, note me very carefully. There is a lot not to like about Christianity as it manifests itself in our culture. To say there is not a lot to like is probably a stronger statement than I mean to make. But there is a lot not to like about Christianity as it manifests itself in our culture. I have known many people who are deeply embittered against Christianity. Story after story of people who have been hurt by Christians. Story after story about Christians who are judgmental or unloving or hypocritical or controlling or legalistic or whatever. If Christians are such stars shining in the world, why do we have such a bad reputation? And even worse, why does it seem so often that we deserve that reputation? Well, I have said it before and I'll say it again. When religion goes bad, it is one of the worst things in the world. This was Jesus' charge against the Pharisees. The Pharisees were very religious people. They were dedicated to the law. But at heart, they wanted something different than what the law of Moses was really calling for. Now, if you don't really want to submit to what the law of Moses is calling you to, you could just blow it off. You could just say, stupid law, I don't want to have anything to do with it. But there's another way to evade what the law requires, which is to embrace it fully, but to distort its meaning, to hide behind it, to use it as a cover for what you really want to do. And this is what Jesus was accusing the Pharisees of, that they were supposedly keeping the law, and yet they held on to their self-righteousness. They justified their own sexual immorality. They were greedy and materialistic. They were unloving. They were followers of the law that said, love your neighbor as yourself, and yet they justified their unloving attitude in the name of that law. The law becomes a way to feel better than other people, and even a way to gain material wealth in that culture. Well, the same thing is true of Christianity. It can be true of Christianity. Christianity, in its reality, calls on the willing heart to submit, to humbly admit sin, to set one's hope on the kingdom of God, to forgive others as you have been forgiven, and we could go on as to what the heart attitude is that the Christian gospel is calling us to embrace. But if your heart is not willing to submit to that, you don't have to reject Christianity altogether. There are a lot of advantages in joining the church. There can be an emotional payoff or a social payoff. There can be a financial payoff. It happens every day. In spite of all that, I still believe that there is such a thing as genuine faith in the world. I still believe that there are people in this world who follow Jesus sincerely, and to me, They are indeed stars shining in the darkness. Their humility is genuine. Their willingness to learn more about how to love others is genuine. Their love of Jesus and the salvation he brings is genuine. And it stands out in the world. It not only stands out against the general unbelief that pervades our world, the open hostility to God, it stands out in contrast with the perversion of Christianity that we sometimes find in the world. These are people who are willing to admit that they're wrong. They are people who are willing to try to be at peace with their fellow believers. They are people who long to do what is right, however much they may struggle. They are people who are grateful to God for his generosity and want to be generous themselves. This is a very real thing in the world. I said last week, or somewhere along the line, I said that I have seen this, and I think many of you have seen it too. It is very real. It is very imperfect. I do not know one person that I have looked to in genuine gratitude for their faith that I have not also looked at and it's been quite clear to me that they are sinners and they're messed up. I mean, those things are always going to go together in this age. Every genuine believer is also a genuine sinner. But just as the sin is real, the willingness to embrace the truth is real as well. So I'm not embarrassed by this language about those with a growing and genuine faith being like stars in the darkness. That is what they have been to me. And I think I understand what Paul's talking about, as bad as it can look sometimes. Personally, I tend toward a very dour and depressed attitude toward life. I don't know if you've noticed that or not, but I do tend in that direction. But sometimes I have to pull myself up short and remind myself that God is doing a great thing in the world. And if you're willing to look, I think you can see the stars shining. Okay, so we have a few minutes for any questions or comments you might have.
Verse 17, he talks about the sacrifice in service of your faith.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that was an allusion to something like what Paul mentions in Romans 12:1? Is that? Did you?
I did not, but it's similar sort of liturgical language that's being used there. So yeah, I think it probably is a similar sort of thing. So the Romans 12:1 passage, go ahead and.
Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is the logical service of your worship.
Right. So I think a similar sort of thing could be in informing what he's doing there. Their genuine faith, their living out the gospel, is being compared to a sacrifice that has been put on the altar. And then Paul is comparing his efforts to encourage them, to teach them the gospel and so forth, as like the drink offering that is poured along with that sacrifice. Yeah, so that I think there's a nice connection there.
How far would that expand in that if you're a Jew and you accepted the fact that God's eyes are always on me, so how I behave in my own home matters, and I have this dance, in a sense, that I have to learn and do, and I have to go through these steps. I have ritual, you know, I have temple ritual that I do. And these people have never have had that, or have had it and now have left it. And you see, making that illusion that, you remember how you used to have this way of publicly conforming to the requirements of the law and acting it out? Well, now you do that with your life on a moment-to-moment basis. That the, you know, loving your wife, teaching your kids, being true to your neighbor, that is your service. And that comes to you, that is motivated by your faith in the one God.
Right. So tell me if what I'm about to say speaks to your question here. But there is some debate about this, because as pagans, they had a background that involved offerings and libations and stuff like that as well. So some have argued that Paul is appealing to that background that they would have had. I don't think that's probably right, especially with the concept of the drink offering and the sacrifice. It seems very rooted in the temple as the law set it out. I'm assuming, because see, in the Romans 12 passage, his point is to kind of make that connection. I want you to shift your thinking from ritual to the actuality of life kind of thing. If that's at the back of what he's doing here in Philippians, it's only in the back. His main purpose is to just have this metaphor that he's using to describe the relationship between his ministry and their faith. So I just have to assume, I mean, we know that they would have been familiar with the Old Testament, many of them, even though they were Gentiles. You may remember from if you heard the first talk here, or if you know the book of Philippians and the book of Acts and what's going on there, that the first believer was Lydia, the merchant in purple cloth, and she was described, basically, she is a Gentile who was a God-worshipping Gentile, which means that she would have been familiar with the Old Testament. Even though she was a Gentile, she would have been going, and in her hometown where she was from, she would have been going to the synagogue and becoming familiar. So the fact that they're Gentiles being talked to, we always have to remember that it's not necessarily problematic that Paul would make an allusion to the Old Testament because they have familiarity with that. And now that they're Christians, I'm sure, I mean, they don't have the New Testament to educate them in. If they're going to talk about the scriptures with new Gentile converts, the scriptures they're going to talk about are going to be the Old Testament. So they're becoming familiar with that stuff. So I would assume that Paul can make an analogy like this, thinking they'll know what I'm talking about. They'll get that. I don't have to explain that to them. And maybe even he may be aware that in his own teaching, the sort of thing that he said in Romans 12 has been expressed to them, that this would be a familiar idea to them, that in a sense, the offering of their lives and their faith is the more meaningful counterpart to the ritual sacrifice before. He may have even told them things like that before. So,
thanks.
I was just wondering if it was a possibility of verse 17 in chapter 2 to be a third but to verse 22 and 23 in chapter 1, with the exhortation being bookstop between these but statements.
Okay, so you're talking about where he's talking about, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain.
Right.
If I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose.
Right, and then, but I am hard-pressed from both directions, having
right.
desire to depart, be with Christ.
Right.
And then he moves on to this exhortation,
mm-hmm.
and then he says, but again, but even if I'm being poured out as a drink offering, if he was referring back to
right.
the Lord taking his life.
Right. Okay. Got you. If by the drink offering he means he's talking about his death, mm-hmm. which it doesn't have to be, but if it is that way, which it could very well be, then in a sense that's kind of implicit in what I'm getting at. It's all tied together. He has been talking about how he, either he's going to die or not in this situation. So yes, he is referring back to that. That's part of what it is that he's bringing into it. But we do also have the fact that after he says that hard-pressed, he's not sure which way, he expresses his confidence that in fact he's going to get off and live. And a couple verses after this, that we read it earlier there today, he says again, I expect to be coming to see you soon. So he has expressed that the possibility that he might not make it, and that if he were to die, that would be gain for him to go and be with Christ. But he has also very strongly in those situations expressed his confidence that he doesn't think that's what's going to happen. So at this spot, if he is bringing up the idea that he might die again, it is also, it's not going back to it in the sense that it is abandoning what he's talked about in the middle, because what he's already said he thinks he's going to get off, but here what he's saying is, even if I don't, I rejoice in the fact that what I have done in preaching to you has resulted in the sort of result that I've been talking about here, that you have worked out your salvation and that in the end when Jesus returns that I will not have run in vain and so on. So both, I think, would be true. If he's talking about his death, it is referring back to that, but it's also wrapping up what he's saying.
That's what I thought.
Okay, good.
And illustrating that to die is Christ.
Right.
Not just living for Christ, but to die is
right.
Christ.
Right.
My question is, in verse 16, where he says, "Hold firmly to the message of life, then I can boast in the day of Christ that I did not run or labor for nothing."
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have a quandary about him wanting to boast.
Ah, okay.
It sounds like he's being a little bit gratuitous and he's sort of laying a guilt trip on them, maybe.
Okay. Okay, yeah, we don't exactly have a word, I don't think, that captures the flavor of the word that Paul uses for boast. It's a word he uses in several places. He can use it in a way that it does not have the negative connotation that we associate with it. That is, the thing that you boast in is the thing that you point to with satisfaction. It's not saying, "Look how great I am." It's saying, "This is something that I am pleased is a part of my life," is the way I would understand it. It can be negative, but Paul, the most striking use of the word boast is in the Romans 5 chapters, well, in the first part of Romans, where he, in the negative connotation, he's talking about how the Jews boast in the law or boast in God. And he's arguing that this boast is not appropriate because it's not true. The law can't really reconcile us to God in that way. But in Romans 5, he says that we as believers, having been justified by faith, we boast in hope of the glory of God. We boast in our tribulations. And then he says we boast in God. Well, it's the same word that we're talking about here, I'm pretty sure. But it doesn't work really to say, "Hey, I got trouble, you know, like I'm hot stuff." That's not what the word means, but it is,
I want to relate it to make my joy complete, to speak joyfully of how, you know, my work was not in vain, but the word boast kind of.
Okay. Well, remember, I mean, maybe this helps to take some of the edge off of it, is that Paul can't do anything about it. That is, there is nothing that he can do to make them be believers. He's exhorting them. He has taught them. But if they arrive there at the end, he can't boast, "Look, I got them there," because he didn't. And he knows that this is why he has to urge them to make this choice, because he is powerless to do anything about it. So the boast, it's not a boast that, "Oh, look at the great... look at how great I did in getting them there," but it is pointing with satisfaction to the fact that, this work that I did with them, in the end, they arrived. That's great. And not, "I'm great," but that's really great that happened. So, yeah, I agree with you. If he's trying to say, you know, "I'm hot stuff," then that would not be something we would want to emulate, but I don't think he is. Okay, thanks.